In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Greetings, Earthlings, and welcome to Autopsy 2. A chase through the history of action films with my very special guest, Jeff Rovin. It's safe to say that even if you recognize that name, you probably don't know the half of it. Hell, you probably don't know the tenth of it. Even I probably don't know the tenth of it, even though I've known Jeff since 1974. In fact, Jeff is largely responsible for my career, lucky us, having given me my first job in publishing as assistant editor of the Seaboard Periodical and Atlas Comics line. Since then, I've heard him referred to as the Rolls-Royce of ghostwriters, but he started writing mostly under his own name back in the 60s, producing entire encyclopedias of pop culture, scores of novels, as well as countless, and in this case, countless is actually not an exaggeration, magazine and newspaper articles, until the industry changed so much, he realized he didn't have to anymore. But that didn't slow him down. So, okay, maybe he knows publishing, but what's he doing on a movie podcast? Well, in addition to being the Rolls-Royce of ghostwriters, he also is the dean of entertainment experts, the man many studios, networks, and law firms call upon when they need someone with extensive knowledge and unquestionable authority. Let me see if I can pronounce that properly. Unquestionable authority. There we go. So, get ready. Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy Number 2 with my guest movie medical examiner, Jeff Rovin.
I'm talking to Jeff Rovin, and I imagine everybody listening now knows who you are because I'm planning to do wraparounds for these, which was I'll introduce you and tell you the circumstances. We don't have to get into our long history, but and I've also promoted you to the sky because you probably won't do that for yourself or wouldn't be interested in doing that. So let's get right into it. Your action film life, your action movie life. When did action movies start for you?
Probably in, well, certainly in the 1950s on television when all of the old films were sold to WOR and WPIX in New York, and you got to see things like Gunga Din and some of the old Tim Holt westerns and that sort of thing. In movies, it would have been Steve Reeves' Hercules, that period.
Oh, what are those called?
The Sword and Sandal. The Sword and Sandal pictures, of which Hercules was the first.
The first in Italy or the first in America?
That was the first.
Anywhere.
It was the first. I mean, it did discount a lot of the older movies that didn't have that tag of
right.
Sword and Sandal. But it was the first of the He-Man type pictures.
Peplum, that's what they're called. Peplum.
Well,
the official title.
The official title over there.
Yeah.
But that was such a revelation.
Hercules specifically was the revelation
Hercules
for you.
It was so thrilling. It was, you know, to a 7 or 8 year old, it was perfect.
It's funny. I remember seeing that as well. I can't remember when I saw it. I do remember for years after, my father would play Hercules Unchained with me and my brother where we were at the beach, and he would pick us up and hurl us into the surf, and we'd cry out, Hercules Unchained!
Well, of course, that was the scene with Antaeus, who got strength when he was thrown to the ground.
Right.
From his mother Earth, and so Hercules threw him into the water where he got no strength.
Right.
And that was Hercules Unchained, of course. But at the same time, talk about a golden age, at the same time, Disney Zorro
was
on ABC.
Oh, with awesome sword fighting.
It to this day, there has rarely been as much action in a television series, legitimate action. I'm talking about action where you have stuntmen who could run across the backs of horses.
Yeah. I mean, I think let's distinguish between legitimate versus illegitimate.
Well, I can do that actually very concisely.
Go.
There was a period up until the 1950s or so when, of course, Hollywood had horses and riders and stunt people who were trained specifically to do that kind of thing. But as the Westerns fell out of favor, certainly by the 60s, you had fewer and fewer of those. When there was a transition to television, those brilliant professionals, many of whom were trained by Yakima Kennett and Glenn Randall Sr., just moved into television. And Disney shot the Zorro series as if it were a feature film. Mm-hmm. He spent money on it. Of course, a lot of the episodes were added into feature films released theatrically. And that was, it was, it, to this day, they are still thrilling to watch.
Yeah, I maintain that an audience can tell when you have somebody who knows what they're doing and what they're not, and it's more thrilling to see them actually ride, actually use sword fighting, not cutting or editing. They're actually taking the sword, and they're doing things that you can't do until you are very well trained to do
them. Correct. And we're talking about an era when people came into films like Ben Johnson, like Gary Cooper, who could ride Tyrone Power. Mm-hmm. You watch him at the beginning of Captain from Castile, he has to have dialogue on horseback, and it's a medium shot, so it's not like you had somebody standing there holding the reins out of frame. Mm-hmm. He is just moving this horse around so he can continue to talk to the young lady in the scene, I forget who it was. But he and certainly Heston and Burt Lancaster, these guys knew what they were doing. And if they didn't know, they learned before they did it. Mm-hmm. Lancaster in particular.
They wanted to be in command. There's nothing like a horse taking the actor out of control of the scene.
Exactly.
And I could tell that even, but it wasn't until I started riding horses much later that I would, now I look upon Gary Cooper with awe.
Absolutely.
Because he seems glued to the horse. And having ridden, you know, as soon as the horse moves, you hop up. And Gary Cooper was just like a straight line, no matter how fast or slow he was riding.
Sure, and look at all of the movies that, go back to Wings, for example. If those pilots, if those actors couldn't fly the planes, it would be, you know, a quarter of the movie that it actually is.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that can replace that. And I think that we've lost a lot in action movies because all of the extras highlight the precautions that are taken to wire harness mm-hmm. stunt people so that when they get shot or knocked off a motorcycle, they're actually being supported.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't want people crippled like Bob Morgan was in How the West Was Won. I mean, there's a scene in How the West Was Won during the Cheyenne attack when a rider falls off a horse and then the horse rolls over him.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept it in the film, but there's no way that that guy got up and it was fine.
I remember they used to take it as a point of honor to keep the scene where the person was crippled or had their neck broken in the movie in honor of that stuntman.
Yeah, I think it was in Hallelujah Trail.
That's what I was going to mention.
Where there's one of the wagons takes a huge jump and two of the guys got off the buckboard part of it and the guy inside didn't
mm-hmm.
and was killed, and the scene is still in the movie.
Look at
Jackie Chan.
Look at
all of those scenes. Mm-hmm. They're not only in the movie, they're replayed at the end.
Repeatedly.
Yeah.
But there was also that scene in the William Holden, I believe, John Wayne Western, where Ryder almost falls off and you see his head or his neck hit the bridge.
It was when they were going across a bridge or
right.
something. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it, the Undefeated? That broke his neck. Yeah.
And they kept it in.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I don't believe that fellow died or was paralyzed for life the way how the West Was Won.
Bob Morgan.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yes, we don't want stuntmen to be hurt, but at the same time, we don't want actors or stuntmen or characters in a movie to look like they're pumped up with air and have no weight. Now, I would love to take you to the new Ben-Hur.
I won't go. I knew you were going.
But there's
no reason to go mm-hmm. other than to be annoyed. Because, look, Heston learned to drive the chariot.
Charlton Heston, people.
Correct.
Yeah.
Stephen Boyd did not learn, but he faked it well enough.
Yes.
One of the reasons that Stephen Boyd kept his helmet on during the race is so that they could substitute a stunt actor to race with Heston, who makes a point of taking his helmet off before the race.
Yeah.
But still, when Joe Kennett, doubling for Heston in that one shot, is thrown out of the chariot, no, we don't want stunt people to be hurt. But boy, that is thrilling. The whole mm-hmm. thing is thrilling. It will still be thrilling in 50 years.
Yeah, Ben-Hur, the new Ben-Hur is not thrilling, even though we haven't seen it yet. Doesn't matter. We're not intending to see it. Now, is the chariot race in the original Ben-Hur with Charlton Heston, the best action scene ever.
I believe it is. Now, keep in mind, the 1925 version of Ben-Hur has an awfully good chariot race, but there are cheats in that now and then where frames are removed to speed up the action and so on and so forth. It's still awfully impressive.
Yeah.
But for 11 minutes in Ben-Hur, you see not only actors and stunt actors in genuine risk, because those chariots are going all out. And if you look at that extra, the extras where Joe cannot lose his control of one of the chariots and it crashes into a camera, this was real, or as real as it's gonna as it's ever gonna be. Let me digress to that scene in what the heck was the name of the Harold Lloyd movie where he lost control of the cart and hit the elevator?
Oh, that's
train.
Right. That was a wonderful. That takes place.
Speedy.
Around,
it was Speedy. It was actually filmed outside my building here
in New York. Yeah.
Right, and he lost control. He crashed into the stanchion of the elevated train. Left it in the film. Improvised on the spot to replace the wheel with a manhole cover. And continued on acting. You know, seeing me, seeing Buster Keaton, seeing all of those great stunt people, including Harold Lloyd and Safety Last, even though there were precautions taken, these are guys up on the faces of buildings and going crazy in the streets of New York. That's why these movies endure.
Not just that. I was going to add, in addition to the verisimilitude, which we used a lot because that was emblazoned on the set of Superman in London, verisimilitude. Yeah. So explain Otis to me. Never mind. That's an old wound. Yeah. I think I've already addressed it on the show. More than the verisimilitude of the Ben-Hur chariot race, it is so beautifully conceived, directed, acted, and edited that even if there weren't those moments of real danger, it would remain far more thrilling than virtually anything we can see today.
And there's no musical accompaniment during that sequence.
Right.
There's so many movies are pumped up by the music, pumped up artificially. But there was also the conflict between Ben-Hur and Misawa. I mean, I think it had been building for 3 hours in a four-hour movie. So by the time it is finally unleashed, and when Stephen Boyd finally turns to whip Heston out of just sheer frustration, you're right there with him. You're right there with both of them. You feel the pain of it, even in the midst of this thundering race.
Right.
There's that humanity, which is surely why William Wyler was hired to direct this picture.
Right. William Wyler, that's the hero of Ben-Hur. Charlton Heston is magnificent, but some directors didn't know how to use him. And Stephen Boyd, his performances go up and down depending on the director.
Correct.
So if the director is, and we're going to have a lot of episodes, I'm sure, on James Bond, and it's the same thing with James Bond. Sometimes it's great. It's usually because the director has a sure hand. And Wyler was just one of the greats.
Well, one of the things, since you bring up James Bond, and you and I have discussed this before, is one of the problems that Bond has now is Roger Moore years ago on the set of For Your Eyes Only said, the day that one of these movies stops to have James Bond address the camera and say, I never had any toys as a child, is the day that the series dies.
Yes.
And God knows Daniel Craig has killed it with that.
My review of Spectre was, I have never seen a film with its head so far up its own ass.
Yeah.
I mean, he takes navel gazing to an intestinal degree.
Almost like a Robert Crumb illustration where you become what you behold.
Yeah.
It's,
well, and of course, that's one of the things that the great glory of talking to you, because you know and knew Heston. You knew Burt Lancaster. You spent a lot of time with Roger Moore. You are an encyclopedia. So could you give us a capsule, or take as long as you want, of action cinema and how it developed from an action standpoint?
There was a sense of discovery. If you go back to the Great Train Robbery, which was, 1903, I think, from that period until Stagecoach, John Ford's Stagecoach in 1939, Hollywood and the people making those movies were discovering what they could do, what they couldn't do. For example, in 1936, with the Charge of the Light Brigade, they were still using tripwires to take down the horses. There are very few scenes as thrilling as the Charge of the Light Brigade at the end of that movie, but I don't think a horse survived.
Oh, no.
Because, you know, they would tie their legs with wire, and the wire would be hammered into the ground, and when the wire reached its end, the horse would fall down.
Mm-hmm.
And the rider would typically go over the front
yes.
of the horse, which wasn't so good for the rider either.
But at least he was prepared.
He was prepared for it and yeah. knew how to take that fall. Yakima Canutt came along by the time of Stagecoach. He was the great stunt director. He was a rodeo rider turned stunt director. And the thing about rodeo riders is that they learn how dangerous a horse can be, in the sense that gravity plays a large part in your fate on horseback. Because
mm-hmm.
you're going up and then coming down while the horse is still on its upward movement. So you're taking two hits for every buck. So Yakima Canutt learned to connect with horses and love them. Anyway, he didn't want them hurt. So they came up with things like the Flying W, where you could use the reins to pull the horse down and basically do a horse fall. So by the time of Stagecoach, where Yak was playing both the people and the passengers in the Stagecoach and the Indians who were attacking, everyone who fell off a horse was basically Yakima Canutt.
Yeah.
But it's thrilling because these are tearing across the plain. The horses, the coach, the camera, everything is moving. That was sort of the pinnacle of that sense of discovery,
mm-hmm.
which isn't to say that other movies didn't have as exciting scenes.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, a lot of the gags, the techniques, were basically being refined instead of rediscovered. Or newly discovered, yeah. So it lost some of the freshness. Look at 1939, where you had Gunga Din. Also, although a lot of that was the action was sped up, so it's
mm-hmm. yeah.
not quite fair. But you had all of those great movies, those action movies. You had Gone with the Wind, which you know
it was an amazing action movie.
You know, yeah, yeah. And people forget that because it's lost to
it's other things too.
Yeah,
but let's go back, because one of the great moments. Two of the great moments in early film history was that initial film of a train coming toward the camera.
Sure, I think it was the Lumiere. Was it?
Yeah,
Lumiere.
One of the. But that's Brothers. The thing that's most mentioned, because the audience would scream and dive out of the way, and then the climactic moment from the Great Train Robbery, where one of the villains points the gun at the camera and shoots, and again shocking everyone. So we go back from the Western, we go to the history of the gun in cinema, as well as the fist in cinema, the gun and the fist. And I remember loving the old-time serials. Those were the first things that I saw in the children's matinees, the old-time serials where Spy Smasher and Captain America and Batman and who am I missing, Captain Marvel, would do a lot of, and just a lot of wild fist fights.
Well, because look at the guys you had working in that. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, I can't remember a single one of them.
Tom Tyler?
Tom Tyler was the star, but there are all those great stuntmen, and their names will occur to me, and I'll shout them out as we go along. But they were just wild and woolly.
Mm-hmm.
But also, before that, don't forget, you know, Douglas Fairbanks Sr. did.
Oh, of course.
You know, in Mark of Zorro and Thief of Baghdad, he was doing all kinds of outrageous stunts.
His own stunts.
People came to expect that of him. You had, in movies, one of the problems with a movie, for example, like Birth of a Nation, is that there are some thrilling action scenes
mm-hmm.
in this picture that everybody has grown to detest. Well, most everybody, because of its racial content,
mm-hmm.
Which obscures, unfortunately, the fact that it is great filmmaking.
Yep.
For 1915, it's 101 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Intolerance has some extraordinary action sequences the following year, 1916. You know, the whole Babylon sequence, just in terms of scale, was unprecedented. But one of the things that obscures the quality of the action is that these are still genre movies. You know, Thief of Baghdad is a fantasy. Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind are historical epics.
Mm-hmm.
The Silent Ben-Hur is basically, you know, a melodrama, you know, subtitled The Tale of the Christ. So,
mm-hmm. right.
You know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, pure action movies are a different thing altogether.
Very much so, yes.
So I think we have to distinguish between them. But you're right, the movie serials, it didn't matter what the genre was. It was the same fights. It was the same cars driving off a cliff.
Right.
It was the same scenes shot in Coldwater Canyon or up in the Hollywood Hills. And the same miniature, types of miniatures with racing trains and exploding bridges.
And don't you think that basically, I mean, I'm thinking of Jimmy Cagney. And I think, was it Public Enemy, where the machine guns are being shot at him, and on the set they used a real machine gun?
Yeah.
And so the Westerns had guns, the gangster movies had guns, and sometimes real guns depending on what they wanted the effect. But it was just the wild, might as well have been the Wild West, because they weren't being used for a dramatic purpose. They were just used as, I guess, symbols of power. And Jimmy Cagney also was in all the boxing movies. I'm trying to think of a single effective punch in the movies from 1903 to 1939.
Well, Body and Soul was a little bit after that, but that certainly had some plausible boxing scenes. Don't forget, and also let's not ignore the sword also, because Adventures of Robin Hood and Mark of Zorro, the second Mark of Zorro.
And again, that's where actors like Errol Flynn and Basil Rathbone were actually wielding the swords.
Yeah, and you'll see, one would see in Mark of Zorro with Tyrone Power and Basil Rathbone, those are real blades they're using, and they're not the tips are not bent. There are no, they're not made of tin like in DeMille used to break swords. He used to bend them to see if they were real enough, and if they snapped, he didn't want it, obviously. Most people had never seen dogfights, of course. Mm-hmm. They'd never seen boxing matches. They'd certainly never seen gunplay. You would read about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. People went to the movies to live vicariously and even dangerously through these films. And that's why you have them reflecting what's happening in the world, all the gangster movies during the era of Al Capone, or actually just a little bit afterwards. And It's been mentioned by, I think it was Neil Gabler, about how the pogroms of Eastern Europe and Russia were something that the Hollywood moguls brought with them and kind of psychodramatically acted that out in the Westerns. Mm-hmm. So what we were seeing was their experience as beleaguered Jews in the old world, not the experience of the American settlers with Native Americans. So it was all very interpretive, and it was all done to, as I said, give the audience a kind of a vicarious scare, and that adrenaline rush that you and I have both said you just don't get anymore.
Yeah, with the CGI movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's true. Also, you reminded me of the war movies.
Yeah, well, the Wings. There's simply nothing as exciting as that silent film.
Yep. But John Wayne, who is certainly one of the foundations of action film, between his Westerns, his war movies, his straight detective films. And ignore that duck. That's all right. We've had a lot of instances during the recording of these podcasts of real life intruding. Jeff is a very busy man, and deservedly so, which you'll hear about the wraparounds. But I'm thinking of pure action, the movies that thrilled me. War movies thrilled me. The serials thrilled me. Westerns. The gangster pictures. I personally also loved detective and cop pictures, but those were rarely action movies.
Yeah, you had the occasional movie like, what was it, T-Man or something like that. Mm-hmm. Some of those hour-long movies. The Mike Shanes occasionally had action in them. The real dichotomy of a lot of action movies is that, particularly in war, one of the most thrilling scenes ever was the helicopter attack in Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
In what is an anti-war film and an anti-war moment, and yet you can't help but be thrilled by it.
Well, it's that brings it back to me for The Longest Day.
I was about to mention that.
The Dirty Dozen.
The storming of the beaches in The Longest Day, especially with the point of view shot from the German plane strafing the beach. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is horrible, but my God.
Yeah, it's a movie.
It's a thrilling scene.
The whole idea of movies is that you're able to feel things in a safe environment, like a roller coaster. That's, in a way, I hate it when producers refer to their films as it's a real roller coaster ride, which means that it's a terrible movie. But in the best of the roller coaster movies, including things like the disaster movie chain, yeah, let's get... So the 40s, we've got the war movies. We've been through the golden age of the Western, the golden age of historical. Again, you were very close to Charlton Heston, who is responsible for some of the great epic performances and action movies of all time.
Yeah, and before that, movies like Secret of the Incas, where he was, you know, wearing the leather jacket and the fedora and going to seek an ancient artifact.
Jeez, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Naked Jungle?
You know, A Naked Jungle was another one. He did Far Horizons, Lewis and Clark. Mm-hmm. He was, I forget the one. Oh, Pony Express.
Pony Express.
He did a lot of those. And he might, without Ten Commandments and Ben-Hur, he might have gone the way of a lot of other kind of B-level action stars. And mm-hmm. I don't mean that as a pejorative.
Right.
You know, but there's only so much room for Randolph Scott's and Joel McRae's.
Right.
And Heston was a little bit late for that. So he found a niche and then wisely transitioned into other roles, science fiction and disaster.
Omega Man,
yeah.
Well, also, without he had one of the great screen fights in The Big Country.
Yeah, exactly.
With Gregory Peck.
Right.
It's an awesome drag-out, knockdown screen fight.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Parts of which were filmed in the arena from Ben-Hur, by the way, because Wyler felt they needed some pickup shots for close-ups. Because, as you know, that fight is... There's a lot of long shots.
Yeah.
It's
The Big Country.
So they flew Gregory Peck over. They threw some scrub down in the Sandy Arena, and Wyler shot his close-ups for The Big Country there. But yeah, you know, he and Burt Lancaster in particular. You know, Burt was he was a circus acrobat, not an actor. And when he went into movies and did things like The Crimson Pirate or The Flame and the Arrow, they always worked in kind of high wire scenes,
yeah,
or anything that could harken back to his
flipping and all the rest of it. And also, I'll call him Chuck
because
I know Charlton Heston, that was his nickname. And Bert did these wonderful latter day films a little later on in their career, like The Train with Burt Lancaster, and as we mentioned, The Omega Man. And what are some of the other? Oh, Soylent Green. Just awesome, yeah. Awesome action performances.
Well, we just saw the Go Tell the Spartans, which Burt was in his mid 60s, I think, when he did that Vietnam picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Wayne was still doing them too, but less convincingly. And again, that's not a knock. Burt was just a lifelong athlete, and so was Heston. And I would say that, you know, in the 1980s, we had a glimmer of that with Stallone and, to a lesser extent, Schwarzenegger. Stallone, who I also knew we were going to work on a movie together, he really took pains to learn whatever it was he had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when he played Rambo, he not only looked the part, he was convincingly adept with the weapons.
Oh, yes.
And the knife and the tools and everything.
The bow and
else.
Arrow.
The
yeah.
Bow and arrow, because he took the pains to learn that stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of actors didn't.
Oh, yeah.
And again, there often isn't time, like I said about Stephen Boyd and Ben-Hur. However, I will say this about Boyd. For the scene that he's dragged behind the chariot, he was dragged behind the chariot.
Oh, man.
And he went over and talked to the Italian stuntman about it. And there's a clip on YouTube, an interview clip, actually, where Boyd says, "I told him what I wanted to do, and he looked at me and said, 'You want to die? Go die.'" but there was, as you said, a sense of pride. You certainly know this from the Chinese films, the Hong Kong films. These guys didn't want to lose face. They
mm-hmm.
wanted to get in there and do it. And this was certainly the case with Tyrone Power. It's what killed him, ultimately, doing the sword fight with George Sanders and Solomon and Sheba. Because Sanders wasn't adept with the sword, Power was. And he did something like 30 takes
mm-hmm.
in the heat of the set. And Power just dropped dead at 44, I think.
Yeah. He did other things. It was, you know, he was a heavy smoker and all sorts of other
smoker,
drinker,
sure, you know, sure, like absolutely. But my point is that he didn't let anything stop him from doing as much as he could.
Yeah. Did you ever talk with Heston and with Burt Lancaster? Did they ever share with you some of their feelings on the action that they do and how they do the action and maybe one of the techniques they would use to make it stronger?
Well, Heston always said that he relied on the people who knew what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
The stunt coordinator in the chariot race famously said, "Chuck, you just make sure you stay in the chariot. I'll make sure you win the race." you know, and when you go and apply yourself and have that kind of a tutor, you get to a point where you can actually do this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, Bert, both men had been in the Army during World War II, or Chuck was in the Air Force. So you are around people who are really proficient in the kinds of skills that may not directly relate to what you're doing in a movie, but just that sense of proficiency, mm-hmm. that sense of focus. You're aware of what it takes to do the job,
mm-hmm.
whether it's fixing a plane, because Heston was up in the Aleutians, or Bert was in the European theater. So you learn what it's like to actually use a weapon.
Yeah.
And so...
You never see them holding it sideways.
No, they don't do that sort of thing.
No.
And Heston, of course, grew up having to hunt to eat in
yes.
the Michigan woods, which also informs a lot of other aspects of your life. When he was working on Major Dundee, I remember he had gotten into a dispute with Sam Peckinpah over... They were shooting a scene. They didn't want to lose the sunlight. It was just perfect. And Peckinpah said, you know, come in at a gallop. So Heston came in at a gallop. And Peckinpah screams, "I said come in at a canter." And Heston drew his saber and charged down on Peckinpah and stopped like a reining horse. He stopped him and it skid to a stop. And he said, "You said a gallop." And he went back and they reshot it as a canter.
Oh, man.
But these guys had to know what they were doing.
You can, you know, it's just like what I was saying with writing. If they're bouncing when they ride, you can tell they're not very good. And when they blink when they shoot, you can tell they're not very good.
Yeah.
You know, you watch Bert, you watch Charlton Heston, and when they shoot, their eyes open.
Yeah. I know Eli Wallach took a lot of heat for that in Magnificent Seven. He said, "Not only wasn't I good with the gun, I had to look at the holster to put it back in."
So, and he made it work.
He absolutely made it work.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was also a sense of topping oneself, which continued into the 60s. You know, we've spoken about this. After the chariot race in Ben-Hur, which was done real without rear screen projection, everything was done on that set. You know, for How the West Was Won, things had to be done real as much as possible. For Mutiny on the Bounty, you had to build a ship and go out and sail it.
Mm-hmm.
Things had to be real. And we lost that sense of realism somewhere.
Well, we can start to trace that, because that's what I wanted to hit next. We've got to World War I. Things started changing in the 50s with the advent of television. And again, a lot of action went to television, although it's... Everybody, I believe, started doing action in a very practical way because they really didn't have time anymore.
They didn't have time or the talent pool. I mean,
yeah.
That was dwindling. Look, the Westerns went to television. Tales of Wells Fargo, Bonanza, Gunsmoke.
Yeah,
even before the so-called adult Westerns of mm-hmm. the mid and late 50s, you had the kiddie Westerns, which were basically the movie serials, but done for television,
right.
The Lone Ranger,
cheaper, quicker,
Archery, right?
Yeah, Bob
Long
Cassidy, yeah,
yeah. So action moved to television. The gangster movies, The Untouchables, that moved to television.
Remarkably violent for its day.
The Untouchables was incredibly violent. M Squad,
you know, with Lee Marvin.
Lee Marvin. You had all of these World War II veterans. You know, Lee Marvin was a Marine, again, mm-hmm. to my point of these were guys who knew what they were doing physically, mm-hmm. who knew how to carry themselves. So that moved to television. And simultaneously, you entered that kind of era of the anti-hero. So you had Easy Rider, and you had fewer and fewer movies that were about traditional heroes, so you didn't need traditional action scenes,
right,
which were being done for television. Even by 1966 in Batman, the Green Hornet, Bruce Lee,
mm-hmm.
that kind of wonderful action stuff was really being nurtured.
Yeah.
On television. And it stayed there for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know that Bruce Lee saw an opportunity and went back and took that to Hong Kong and created an industry.
And opened the world.
Absolutely.
With Enter the Dragon, yeah.
Which, if you think about it, we can't ignore what was happening in Japan at this time, because you had all the Kurosawa samurai films, mm-hmm. Toshirô Mifune, Takashi Shimura, all of these great, great actors who also could do action.
Mm-hmm. Shintaro Katsu, who played the blind swordsman Asato Ichi, was one of the great screen swordsmen. He never had a stand-in. He never had anybody sub him. And he would do these astonishing moves with the sword against many, many people. Criterion has a box set of all the Asato Ichi movies. And yeah, you watch that stuff and try to figure out how they did it. Because he's it may not be a real sword, but it doesn't matter. Ultimately, in one of the last of the movies, his son wound up accidentally killing a stuntman during the climactic battle in the last Asato Ichi movie that Shintaro Katsu did. So just imagine how Shintaro Katsu, who was pretending to be blind and was completely authentic in that effect, those are really remarkably choreographed action scenes in some of the great action movies ever made.
Sure, and you asked about Heston. He said, if you asked him how do you do it, he said, practice. you think about Kerwin Matthews in The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, where he had to fight the skeleton, and he had to learn to shadow fight. He had to learn working with I think it was Greco who he fought against. First, you go through it a whole lot of times with the actual fencing master. Then the fencing master leaves. You repeat the moves, but you have to stop the sword because the skeleton sword is going to be inserted later.
Yes, as you get, that's a Ray Harryhausen special effect movie in which he created these model animated skeletons to fight Kerwin Matthews as Sinbad.
Correct, and that's right. Something else. You know, we talk about CG effects, and you know, when you replace the human hand with even a human hand working a computer, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing at all.
Doesn't have the literal weight.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
So the action movie sort of didn't exist in its pure form probably until the 80s again, but movies like Seventh Voyage or Sinbad and Jason and the Argonauts and Jack the Giant Killer, the fantasy movies,
mm-hmm.
the kiddie movies had a lot of action to them. But don't forget, Hollywood itself in the 50s transitioned a lot of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
We lost, you know, the horror and the Western, but it went in other directions. Then, as I said, it went on to television. In the 60s, there was this kind of melange where even movies like Planet of the Apes or Cartoon had great action scenes in it, but that's not what they were known for.
Right. Was it not until Lethal Weapon and Die Hard that we started getting back into the action movie? I mean, you can't really call that anything other than an action movie.
Correct. I would say actually, you know, Rambo sort of typified it. I know a lot of people will say it was Raiders of the Lost Ark. I would dispute that.
I would dispute that too.
Yeah. So we'll skip over that one. But I would say if you want to see some of those things done expertly, and this is not a knock on Glenn Randall, but this is Raiders was made during that period we talked about when a lot of precautions were being taken to protect the stunt people, and understandably, insurance companies...
Deservedly, yeah.
Yeah, insurance companies got involved, particularly after How the West Was Won and Bob Morgan getting mangled. But if you look at Zorro's Fighting Legion, where Yakima Kanut does the stunt where he goes off of a stagecoach onto the team pulling it, goes down through the team to the hitch rail, does a 180-degree turn with his boot while he's lying on the ground to come out the rear of the stagecoach, climb up the back, and get back into to attack the driver, in two shots. And the reason they did, he wanted to do it in one shot, but I believe the horse stepped on his leg and they had to cut. But it is a remarkable, breathtaking scene. Mm-hmm. And again, with very kind of canned library music. But if you put the Raiders score to that and colorized it and did a comparison test, a taste test,
sure.
You know, you Giacomo Canutt is second to no one.
That is absolutely true. Remember that name, Action Film fans, if you don't know it already. Look him up, Google him, whatever you have to do, Wikipedia him. Giacomo Canutt was the best of the best.
Yeah.
And everybody and Glenn Randall would say so, too.
Sure. And Glenn Randall was, you know, was certainly a brilliant horseman, as was his father. And Talmadge, I forgot, it wasn't Richard Talmadge, I don't think, but whoever did some of the stunts for Samuel Bronston. Again, you talk action scenes. My God, the joust in El Cid is extraordinary. Again, there's a movie without a process shot in it. So I think back in the 80s, you had Rambo, certainly Die Hard, The Killer. You know, that was John Woo.
The John Woo Gun Fu movie.
Better Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I would include probably Silverado in that group, although that was not successful. At least it attempted.
It is wonderful to rewatch if you haven't seen Silverado, especially for Kevin Costner's performance.
Yeah,
you know, you won't even recognize him as Kevin Costner.
Kevin Costner and the other Kevin, you know,
yes,
Kevin Kline.
Kevin Kline.
Scott Glenn. So you had this great cast, John Cleese, in a terrific
one of the great characters and performances.
Yeah, yeah, and I would even add Princess Bride perhaps to that because it had its moments.
It's interesting. Sword movies are prevalent, but when they show up, be it one of my favorites, The Court Jester, with Basil Rathbone versus Danny Kaye, and then later, speaking of Kevin Costner, the fight choreography, the sword fight choreography in Kevin Costner's otherwise somewhat weird Robin Hood is really exceptional. I mean, that's a standout if you haven't watched it lately in terms of the sword work.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I couldn't forgive them for taking swipes at the Errol Flynn movie, and I think it was the New York Times in a moment of rare lucidity where they pointed out it in their review. It's not nice to criticize your betters.
That is absolutely true. Even so, I was impressed, and I later met the choreographer of that movie, the sword choreographer, and he went on to do. I think he did Solomon Kane.
Another underrated, wonderful movie, I thought, from a couple of years ago. But don't forget, though, that the 80s also had, it was that whole Golden Globus era where...
Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris and Michael Dudikoff. So basically it was, you know, any movie with a number after it became the B and C and even Z level movies of that era. And yet, even saying that, there's a level of enthusiastic action.
Abandon, let's have fun.
They weren't mocking it. They weren't contemptuous of it. They weren't afraid of it, like I think so much of Raiders is. They were really sincere about it, and even the two Alan Quatermain movies, because of Richard Chamberlain, no other reason. Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't say that. There was also the source material. The, you know, H. Rider Haggard was one of the great action writers. But you know what? If we want to encapsulate all of this in a kind of a microcosmic flowchart, I would say that Hollywood action movies are a little bit like the literary career of Alastair MacLean. When he came out of World War II, he wrote HMS Ulysses, which was an incredible novel based to some degree on his own war experiences. And thereafter, all of the war set novels that he did, like Guns of Navarone or Where Eagles Dare, had that sense of vitality and discovery, like we talked about in the movies up until 39. After that, when MacLean had learned the formula and he started doing good, serviceable novels like, you know, The Way to Dusty Death and Ice Stage
Force 10 from Navarone.
But even those were still in the zone. But by the time you got to Breakheart Pass and some of the others, Bear Island, he was just not having fun anymore.
Right.
Clearly.
He was doing it for the money.
Correct.
To maintain it. And it's also understandable, as you're a book writer yourself, that you've written that many greats. What are you going to do?
Well, you've got to rediscover and reinvent. And one of the things that Hollywood doesn't do is that.
Yes.
You know, it's
It recycles.
It completely recycles. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that the action movie has fallen on such hard times is, well, you know, we'll do Ben-Hur again, but we'll just do it in 3D with CG and in your face.
Well, and I would counter that it has fallen on hard times, but it's also fallen on good times, because when I was a kid, and I'm pretty sure you too, because we met in a comic book company, we would bemoan the fact that they wouldn't do comic books straight. They wouldn't do it, not seriously, you don't have to be serious, but just straight. I like what Lee Marvin supposedly said, you do your cliche straight, they'll be blinded by your genius. And so I was waiting for Superman to be done the way Richard Donner did it. I was waiting for all my comic book heroes, and today I have that. I have my cake and I eat it too. I was going to ask you if you can think of a single recent film, and we're talking the last 10 years, that legitimately thrilled you.
Well, I think that The Fall, the Tarzan film, had a lot of great set pieces in it, mm-hmm. and I found myself thrilled by that stuff. But really, if you think about how you and I would go to a James Bond movie, and look, for all of its flaws, who is like unto the opening of Moonraker?
Yes.
You know, it's, yeah. You couldn't believe mm-hmm. what you were seeing.
Yes, but when we went to see Captain America Civil War, the moment, and I've mentioned this on other podcasts, the moment where Ant-Man becomes Giant-Man was legitimately thrilling. My heart swelled.
Correct, but that's not about action. That's about childhood sense of wonder being restored, and that's fine too. But you can have both, because mm-hmm. you and I both know that on something like the CW's Flash,
there are
endless exciting scenes that do both.
Yes,
they have such a sense of understanding of that in a way that Arrow doesn't.
Yes. Now that I'm glad you made that segue, because I want to talk about television action. There's lots and lots of television action, but I find it all generic. I find it all remarkably the same. Do you feel, I mean, a fight on Arrow is basically the same as a fight on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. They're all doing the same kickboxing.
Yeah, we've said
mixed
this before.
Arts.
The moments of inspiration on a show like the Netflix Daredevil come from situations and not from fight choreography.
Yeah.
You know, when Daredevil was coming down that staircase, yeah. battling 900 bad guys or yeah. whatever it was, I didn't care what technique he was using. Yeah. He just didn't stop moving. And that was really exciting to see.
You know, it's interesting. I felt about that scene and the best fight scene in the first season of Daredevil.
In the hallway?
Yes. The yeah. way you feel about Raiders of the Lost Ark, because I know where those fights come from. One came from a Korean film called Old Boy, and one came from Ip Man, Ip Man 3, which a lot of people know as IP Man, but it's actually Ip Man.
Yeah. Yeah, wasn't the Old Boy fight the one that started in the elevator?
No.
That ended in an elevator?
That's the Ip Man fight.
The Ip Man fight started
and ended in the elevator.
All right, okay.
And also down the stairway.
Right, I remember that.
The hallway fight was the Old Boy one, which is what Daredevil
right.
did.
Right, oh no, I know that.
And they did a fine job.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at some point on the podcast, we will get into specific autopsies of specific films.
You can do something. Yes,
please.
You can do something referential
mm-hmm.
as long as you bring something additional to it.
Agreed.
You know, and I don't think Raiders did that at any point. I do think Daredevil did that because you had this character who is blind, mm-hmm. and was acting like it. So you and I both know, and I, you know, as from my own martial arts experience, if you fight blindfolded, mm-hmm. you're going to fight differently than you do if you can see. We talked about the blind swordsman before.
Right. Well, that's always the connection I wanted to make between Daredevil is one of my favorite comic book characters, and I loved it because the Zatoichi movies were about blindness, but it was about the villain's blindness, blinded by rage, blinded by lust, blinded by power, while Zatoichi was the blind man who saw better than everyone else because he wasn't afflicted by these things. I was hoping that Daredevil would do the same. I like Daredevil a lot, but I still think they have some ways to go in terms of nailing that.
Oh, you're right. But here's the other thing, too. We touched on this before a little bit with Ben-Hur. One of the things that makes any action scene or sequence or movie so exciting is the humanity or the human element. So, in Rambo First Blood Part 2, when Stallone sits down at the microphone in the POW camp, and there's that lightning flash, and he says, "Murdoch, I'm coming to get you," which is 180 degrees from what he was supposed to say.
Mm-hmm.
Here he is a prisoner. So now you know that anything that gets in a way, his way, is going to be brushed aside somehow,
mm-hmm.
including the guy, who was it? Oh, God, was it Mark Singer? I forget who it was who tried to stop him when he got out of the helicopter. Mm-hmm. He just knocks him away with right. a gun. That's what makes the roller coaster ride so exciting, because you know he's going to do it.
Yeah.
So for the next 30 or 40 minutes, you're just so pumped.
Right, and he does it in a way that you can accept. That you don't go. That you don't go. Oh, that's nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't enter the camp and go, "Camps, I hate POW camps." You know, it's you don't condescend. You don't say what everybody already knows just so they can relate to you. Ooh, mm-hmm. yeah, I hate snakes too. you know, it's so thrilling to see that. And yes, TV is just starting to discover. You know, there were times during Sons of Anarchy where they mm-hmm. achieved that operatic level, but too often misunderstood it and turned it into Shakespearean violence.
Yeah.
But without the Shakespeare.
Here's a rule of thumb for this podcast going forward. If a fight scene can be removed from a television show or a movie without affecting the movie at all, that's not good. All action scenes should be integral to the film, and we'll talk about that in the future, again, in individual autopsy episodes on specific films.
Well, you know, one of the things, and I often have this, not often enough, unfortunately, I have had this discussion with people about literature, too, and invariably you'll talk about the great novels like Moby Dick, and people say, "Oh, you know, so long," and there's all this stuff about how to kill a whale. And
can I slap those people?
Boil down.
Can you bring
the
those people in here so I can slap them?
You can, if that violence can be removed from the conversation
without affecting the
yeah.
conversation at
but
all.
My point of bringing that up is, people say, "Well, I just wish they would leave that stuff out." And I say, you know, this is how you pace a massive novel. Mm-hmm. If it were just wall to wall whale hunt, there's no downtime. There's no time for reflection. There's no time to understand it from the point of view of these people mm-hmm. who you're engaging with. And so it's absolutely necessary. And how do you populate a massive novel? You know, whether it's Moby Dick or Gone with the Wind, these are tutorials.
Yes.
In how to do it. And if these people would look at classic adventure films and not say, "Ooh, let's do that again," mm-hmm. but, "Oh, this is why it works. Let's come up with something that adds to that."
Yes.
Then we would have that thrill that mm-hmm. is missing.
You know, it's funny, I feel that way about The Raid 2 and Conjuring 2. I've had discussions with people that they preferred the original Conjuring and the original Raid because they didn't have all the... They had, in both the sequels, they had a pretty solid hour of exposition and setup that made, for me, the horror in Conjuring and the action in Raid 2 much more justified and much more believable and anchored by the emotion. It wasn't just what I call empty movement, which is just fighting for the sake of fighting. It was anchored to how these people felt and behaved. And I think that's very important, although I enjoy both the Conjuring 1 and 2 and the Raid 1 and 2, but for slightly different reasons, but for that reason, because the sequel, the director and the writers took the time to anchor it to the characters.
Well, that's just it with the kitchen smackdown in Raid 2. You know, by the time you get to these scenes, mm-hmm. you're ready for them.
Yeah.
You know?
It's funny. This just reminds me of, I was writing the Dirty Harry novels for Warner Books, and I wrote the first two, and I was brought into the editor's office, and he goes, "We really, really like these, but could you take out some of the psychology?" And I went, "What psychology?" And they went, "Oh, this part." And they showed me a scene in the second one I wrote. I went, "Oh, you mean the reason he's shooting somebody?" And without blinking, without smiling, he went, yeah, that. Could you take that out?
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Well, yeah, read the next one."
Well, which isn't the same as what we said about Roger Moore talking about James Bond, because if you read the Fleming novels, he always has a line or two of insight.
Sure.
Even though those are fairly slender novels.
Mm-hmm.
I even feel lame critiquing Ian Fleming or Alistair McLean, because their worst stuff is better than our best stuff.
Well, that's just what I was going
to
say.
You know, so it's a little bit, who the hell am I to say these things, or any of us. But we do it as a form of self-analysis, because these guys obviously went through the same process, only they were inventing everything. We aren't.
Right.
And so the challenge to us or to any filmmaker is, how do you do this without simply recycling? And, you know, we faced this with Atlas Comics in 1974, because there was DC and there was Marvel mostly. We tried to create a third look, a third something, but were forced ultimately to do another variation of Marvel.
Yeah. But you freed everyone. You freed everybody from the creative bondage. You gave them their creative control.
Well, that's a separate part of it. The idea that we were trying to come up with something new is the point. And the obstacles against that, from news dealers to publisher to consumer, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
They're all going to want something they're familiar with until they don't.
Right.
You know, and it's that until they don't that's so important.
I always feel it's the publishers who want it, not the audience. It's the publishers who say that. And whenever somebody does something unique, and that was borne out by what happened after Atlas, with the resurrection of comics, with people brought their own sensibilities to it, and suddenly people did want things different.
Well, of course, you had the whole independent creator market, creator-owned comics after that.
ElfQuest.
Yeah, right, ElfQuest. You had Eclipse and Pacific and all those others that came around then. But if you look back also at... God, you know, we mentioned the Untouchables before, but the De Palma film, you know, because of Costner, because of Andy Garcia, because of Connery, and
because of the scripts,
Charles Martin Smith, and De Niro, of course. Yeah, this stuff really had heft to it.
So that's a great thing, because there's a scene in the Brian De Palma Untouchables which is a knockoff of Potemkin.
Absolutely,
Battleship Potemkin.
Yeah.
How do you
Because of what he added to that. The baby carriage going down the staircase could have been really annoying, except for the fact that Andy Garcia slid to catch it and at the same time drew his weapon.
Yeah. What's the difference between a ripoff and an homage?
When you add something to it, and also how long it goes on. I mean, you know, I in the Samuel Bronson film Fall of the Roman Empire, you know, Ben-Hur was such a huge hit, of course, and the chariot race was so renowned. They figure, how can we do a chariot race that's bigger and differenter? And you know, the idea was, we'll have Christopher Plummer and Stephen Boyd race chariots through a mountain pass, knocking down trees and nearly going off a cliff and jumping over this, that, and the other thing and beating each other up and one of them jumping onto the other chariot. And it's an exciting scene. We know why they did it, but the fact of the matter is they did it with such hubris and again, that sense of, you know what, we're just going for it. We know this is ridiculous and it would never happen, but it's going to be thrilling.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, even though in the back of your mind it's, okay, you just did this because you couldn't do another chariot mm-hmm. race like Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
So I think there is an example of their recognizing what came before, mm-hmm. but going in a different direction. It may not be successful. You and I have both written stuff that, you know, I wrote a novel about giant bats attacking New York. Okay, sure, King Kong attacked New York. So the first thing you do is, how do I make this not King Kong?
Right.
That's the job you owe the reader mm-hmm. and the people in whose sandbox you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
How do I make this different enough? And then, how do I call attention to the fact there are these other guys who thought this all up?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
How do I pay tribute?
How do you acknowledge their contribution without just saying, "Oh, it's an homage," and you know, it's you really do have to pay it back and forward too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
That sounds like a good place to stop.
Okay.
I was going to start on the whole thing about the difference between film action and comic book action. But that, I guess, would be for another episode on another day.
Well, one is a storyboard for the other.
That's absolutely true. Well, that's it. That's the whole episode.
Okay, we can talk about that next time.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Rick.
Geez, Louise, that was a lot of references, wasn't it?
By the way, the actress from Captain from Castile that Jeff couldn't remember the name of was Jean Peters. The John Wayne William Holden film I couldn't remember, in which I said a stuntman was hurt, was The Horse Soldiers. Unfortunately, the stuntman, whose name was Fred Kennedy, was actually killed in the accident, which, by the way, so upset the director that he all but stopped filming. Eventually, they found a way to wrap up the movie as quickly as possible, eliminating the original triumphant ending of the script. Okay, what else? Let's see. Terry Walsh was the swordmaster, and Paul Weston was the stunt coordinator on Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. But the gentleman I was referring to is Richard Ryan, the swordmaster of Troy, Solomon Kane, and now the swordmaster on the History Channel's TV series, Vikings. I put all this, a gallery of Jeff's best-known books, pictures of Peters and Ryan, and a bunch of links at the Action Film Autopsy website to help out in case you want more. Otherwise, relax. Take a break. Rest up. You'll need it, because I'll be back in 2 weeks for the summer 2016 Action Film Postmortem Wrap-Up, when things will probably start getting really nasty down here in the Action Movie Morgue. So until then, remember what I always say. Use your blinkers, jackass.
Okay, break it up, break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more film fun, frenzy, and friends. Until then,
a real fight.
Check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.
Solving victory.